Mrs. Forward, Reel 3. Did you ever fly the ATA taxi?
To start with, we did, yes. We took it in turns. And then they had special pilots who did nothing else but taxiing. They went on to Anson's, where they could take minus 8, 10 of us, you know, the bigger planes. So I didn't any longer then.
How frequently did you have to fly priority aeroplanes?
Not that often. There were P1s, they were called. There were a bunch of Spitfires that had to be flown up to Prestwick to be loaded for Malta. You know, when Malta was fighting for its life. And they were being flown out there. Well, they were being shipped out there. And those were all priority ones. And odd ones to squadrons, you know, like that kind of thing. But there weren't that many.
What did it exactly mean when it became a priority?
Oh, it meant you had to get through, if you possibly could, whatever the weather.
What about the aircraft that would be scrapped? How often did you have to take one of those?
Oh, not very often. It was a one-off thing, you know. What we did is we flew a lot of planes. Well, we picked them up from factories and flew them to maintenance units where they had their guns and other odds and ends put on them. And then you flew them from the maintenance units to the squadrons. And then you flew planes from the squadrons back to the maintenance units to be overhauled or to have new guns fitted or, you know. And that was the kind of three-way thing, chiefly.
Did you ever have to take any passengers? RAF personnel, for instance?
Well, we did sometimes give people a lift if they wanted to come down, you know, to where we were going on leave or something. We gave them a lift down if it fitted in, you know. I don't think it was very popular. I don't think we did it very often.
Could you tell me about the conversion courses that you mentioned earlier?
Well, we only had the one when we were from onto Oxford. We were down at it wasn't Uphaven, it was up one. We were there for about 2 or 3 days, I think that's all. On the twin engines, because I'd already flown smaller twin engines at Croydon. And
how did you feel about doing these conversion course? This conversion course.
Oh, thrilled! You know, I was waiting to get for our turn. You know, absolutely thrilled because we knew that once we'd done that, we'd be allowed to fly other planes. You know. It was all very exciting.
Did you feel again there was any pressure upon you to perform well?
No, there wasn't any pressure. I mean, you just did your best, and that was it. You know, nobody queried it.
You started off as 8, and then you say 4 more joined. How else did the ATA expand, and what sort of effect did it have upon you?
Well, they expanded the whole time. You see, they started taking in people with fewer hours and fewer hours and fewer hours, and they got down to... I mean, there were a lot of weekend pilots in those days who'd just done the odd 50 hours, something like that. And they were taken in and trained. And the men, of course, expanded even more rapidly than we did. And anybody who wasn't fit to fly for the Air Force joined the ATA.
How did this affect you, the expansion?
Oh, it didn't really, you know, I mean, except there were more of us, and there were more planes to be flown, because as we flew more and more types of planes, of course, you know, it grew, so it didn't, otherwise it didn't affect us.
How well did you all get on with each other? Because you were living and working quite closely together.
Oh, very
together.
Well indeed. I mean, I don't remember, I mean, I suppose there were some grumbles, and I can't remember any, I mean, as far as I know, everybody got on extremely well together.
What did you do when you were not flying?
Played chess or bridge. Did patiences. Played an enormous amount of bridge.
Was there any social
life? Because one had to wait for hours, you see. and I might arrive in the morning at whatever o'clock was, 8 or half past 8, I can't remember. And the weather was hopeless. So you'd sit around, and if by lunchtime or after lunch they decided the weather wasn't going to lift in time to do any flying, well, then we could go home. So there was an awful lot of hanging on. There always is with flying. Well, in those days, when you weren't flying with a wireless or anything, there was imps hanging around. Well, even now, look at the time you waste at aerodromes when you're flying anywhere, don't you?
Was there any social life attached to the ATA?
Well, it was cancelled in the end, of course, because Amy was killed. Pauline was giving a big party a year to the day that we started flying on the 7th of January. But it was, I can't remember whether we went ahead with it or not. It was a very mooted affair if we did, because that was the day that Amy, she was trying to get back for the party. And that's how she got killed.
How did you cope with losing somebody like Amy and the other people that were lost in ATA?
Oh, bad luck. You know, I mean, tragedy, bad luck. But it can't happen to me. That was one's attitude, you know.
It didn't affect your own flying?
No. No, not in the slightest. But, I mean, you wouldn't drive a car when you read about all the people killed on the roads if it's going to affect you. You just don't. You're very upset, but it doesn't affect your flying. You always find some excuse for it, you know, the engine cut or with bad luck or pilot error.
Did you have any causes for complaint in the way that ATA was organised or the aerodromes were organised?
No, as far as I remember, none at all. It was, I suppose one had one's little grumbles now and again, obviously. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be life, would it? One didn't have a little grumble sometimes, but never anything serious. It was always terribly well organised. Pauline Gar was a superb leader. And as I say, everywhere we went, the people were charming. We were put up in the officers' mess, well, the WAF's mess, generally, or we were given a room. They didn't have a WAF's place where we could sleep. We slept at a pub nearby and always dined in the Air Force mess. And they were absolutely charming. Or lunch. They always gave us lunch if we landed in the morning and weren't taking off till the afternoon. They were absolutely charming, always. And you had a party at night, obviously. One's life seems to consist of parties in those days. One wasn't flying. You never knew what tomorrow would bring. So I made the best of it.
You married when you were in the ATA. What was the official attitude towards marriage?
They didn't seem to mind. You know, they all came to the wedding.
Were you allowed time off?
Yes, I was given... How long I was given? I know Alan had 5 days. I think I was given a week. Too bad for those days, you know.
What about your pay?
Pay was very low, wasn't it? Well, in those days, one wasn't paid very much. I mean, all I can tell you is when I took secretarial job, one of my secretarial jobs, that was before I took up flying, I could speak French and German fluently. I could translate from English to French, or French to German, German to English, you know. And I was working for a man who was in biochemics or something, I don't know. And I was paid 30 bob a week with 3 languages. So those were the wages in those days, you know.
What would you have to pay for your billets when you were with ATA? When you were in Luton, how much would you have to pay?
Oh, I don't know, nothing. Probably a couple of pounds a week, I've no idea any longer. but very, very little, you know. None in those days. It went very much further than it does nowadays, you know. You can't really compare it at all. I mean, if you spent 5 guineas on a pair of shoes, you had a conscience for a month because you, you know, spent that much on a pair of shoes. It was, I mean, terrible.
Did you have to use your clothing coupons for your uniform?
I don't think so. I think we were given coupons. Our shirts we had to use our coupons for, I know that. We had to have blue shirts, and we didn't like the regulation blue shirts, so we always had our own made. So we had to pay coupons for those.
What colour shirts did you wear then?
Blue. We had to wear blue. But, you know, I can't remember much about pay in those days. But, I mean, it was minute compared to what you'd get nowadays. You couldn't compare it, you know. Different world.
Was there any scale of promotion with an ATA?
Yes, you started as a first officer. Second officer. Went up to first officer and captain.
What did you do?
First officer.
Can you tell me how long you were in the ATA? Because you were invalided out.
Yes, I was invalided out in... What did I say? 42, was it?
Yes, I believe October 42 is what you said.
Yes, there we are. That was roughly October. Yes, October the 7th was the last time I flew.
Can you tell me what happened, why you were invalided out?
Well, I just wasn't very well. I'd had this carbon monoxide poisoning and had been in bed for a week or four, well, about a week, I suppose. And then I went back flying again. And then I collapsed again, you know. And I was just ill. I was, I had a series of, you know, I just was ill on and off for weeks then.
How did you get this poisoning?
Through a Typhoon aircraft. Actually, quite a few pilots were killed. I was lucky. It was a very short journey. But the exhaust pipe was too short. And it came up through the floorboards. The exhaust fumes came up through the floorboards. Especially when you were on the ground taxiing. And there had been several accidents, and one man managed to parachute out and told the tale. And after that, until they'd modified them, the ATA were made to wear oxygen masks when they were flying Typhoons. It was just, you know, structural fault.
How soon was it realised that this was what had caused your illness?
I think within a few weeks it happened. You know, that suddenly the news broke that it was that. Because otherwise, I mean, I put it down to that because I'd been held up on the ground for quite a long time waiting to take off. But of course, the doctor said I had carbon monoxide poisoning. It was just kind of lingering effects of it, you know. You went on feeling lousy. I suffered from boils and all kinds of things. And, you know, it just went on and on.
Did you ask to leave?
I think Pauline suggested it. She said, look, you aren't well. I just drag myself down to Luton and hang around there and fly and say, oh, I'm feeling awful. And Pauline said, well, look, I think your best plan is to retire. And so she said, I think you better be invalided out.
What was the procedure?
I have no idea. It just happened. You know, everybody was very nice about it. And then, you know, after that, when I was better, I took this job in the children's nursery and then went on to the Ministry of Information, which was quite fascinating. Because I knew all the secrets that Alan didn't know. Because you saw all the secret photographs. And we had to censor them all, you know, so that none of the flashes of the regiments showed. And we used to have to know which guns were secret and which weren't, and which locations were secret and which weren't. We used to get these piles of photos during the invasion, of course, piles of photos. So it was quite fascinating.
How did you get this job?
Through a friend of mine who was already doing it. She'd been doing it all through the war. And when she knew I'd been invalided out of the ATA, she said, would you like a job at the ministry? I said, yes, I'd adore it. She said, well, there are no vacancies at the moment, but when a vacancy turns up, I'll put your name forward and I'm sure you'll get the job with your qualifications. Because, of course, I could identify all the aircraft. Which helped. You know, so I used to get all the aircraft ones.
And what exactly were your duties?
Just to send the photos. Endlessly, one after another, you know. We had a special pen. Crossed out all the... during the war, when you got things in the newspapers, you know, pictures in the newspapers, you always saw these black marks where things had been censored. And just censor all the photos that had been taken in France or anywhere else.
Were these all official press photographs?
They were all official press photographs, yes. And we did shifts. 1 week we'd work during the day, and the following week we worked at night till midnight. 24-hour shifts.
Whereabouts were you?
Ministry of Information. But it was a very interesting job, you know. I mean, I missed flying terribly, but as a second best, it was an extremely interesting job.
Could you have returned to flying?
I don't know. I suppose I could have done, but by that time, you know, I'd settled in. I didn't start flying again until after the war. And I started flying again. I kept my licence up and flew again after the war.
What did you have to do to keep your licence up?
For the A licence, you only had to do 3 hours. B licence, you had to do more. And you had to have a medical. You had to have to take your medical every 6 months.
And did they pass you on the medical?
Yes. Never had any trouble with that. That's good.
And you stayed at the Ministry of Information until the end of the war?
Yes.
Can you remember VE Day?
Yes, I passed out in opposite Cenotaph. We'd gone there to wait for Churchill to come out on the balcony. And Alan was there, and a friend of ours. And I'm awfully claustrophobic when I get into crowds. It was a fairly hot day. And the crowds were packed like sardines. And I said, I'm beginning to feel faint. And they literally had to carry me feet first out through the crowds into a doorway somewhere. In the end, we saw just as well as if we'd stayed in the crowds. And went on celebrating. Oh, yes, terrific.
And when did you stop working at the Ministry of Information?
I don't know.
Did it continue on after the war had ended?
Not much, no, not very long. No, because we bought a cottage in Arts. My husband went off once again, as usual, to America or somewhere. I think it was America this time. And whilst he was away, I bought this cottage in Arts, which we lived in on and off 14 years, but very much off than on, because we were always aboard. And then we went to Egypt, stationed in Egypt at the time. And that was when we did this flight down to Johannesburg.
Could you tell me about that?
Well, I saw an advertisement in the Egyptian press asking for pilots to fly Fairchilds, which was single-engined aircraft, down to Johannesburg. And I said, well, and I'd like to apply for that. And I was very bored in Egypt, so he said, why not? Thinking it would keep me amused for a few days. And not thinking I'd get the job. You see, thinking as a woman, they'd turn me down. However, when they saw my record of flying, they took me on. And there were eight of us. And I said, my husband wants to come with me, is that all right? So they said, oh yes, but he'll have to pay his return fare. Or not pay for his return fare, he'll have to pay for his hotel accommodation. So I said, oh, that's all right. And they were going to fly us back in Dakota. So anyway, we arrived on the day that we were supposed to take off and found that these Fairchilds had been left by the Americans in wooden crates. And the Egyptians had just flung them together, not having a clue, I don't think, what went where. And we found petrol rags in the tanks and things like that, you know. I had an engine cut, landed. Luckily, I kept going, you know, it cut and came on again. And when they looked at it somewhere in the middle of Africa, they found there was a oil rag in the petrol tank. That kind of thing went on, you know. But anyway, we flew. It took us from November the 11th till the 25th. It took us a fortnight. And it was fun, you know, because we took off about 5, 6 in the morning and landed fairly soon, early in the afternoon, because of the thunderstorms. And we had to land about every 3 or 4 hours. The longest stretch we flew was 3¾ hours without landing because of fuel. And we landed all the way down Africa at various places, and we saw all the wild game, you know, and things.
What were the airstrips like?
Just airstrips, generally with naked natives wandering around them. One occasion, one of the pilots landed in the bush in Uganda, and so we had to stay the night to look for him, and eventually we found him. All these, he phoned through, say he was all right. And so a rescue operation took place. We drove out to this place the next day, and the plane was all right. It wasn't damaged or anything, but he'd landed in thick undergrowth. There was no hope of taking off. So we all set to and cut this down to make a rough strip for him to take off on, you know. And, of course, couldn't get the proper petrol either. But it was great fun.
How many of you were there?
8 of us. And we eventually landed in Joburg and stayed there for about 3 or 4 days. And then flew back in the Dakota. But that little trip, they paid us £50 for that. The large, handsome sum of £50.
How easy was it to find work as a pilot in post-war, the post-war world?
Oh, much easier. Much easier. You know.
And what about prejudices against women? Had they been ironed out because of the war?
To a great extent, yes. Very much so, you know. Because actually the only job I joined the Women's Air Force, whatever it was called, but it didn't work out because we were sent to Alan was sent to Hong Kong. I wanted to join in there, and so I couldn't do my fortnights, you know.
This was in the reserve, was it?
Yes. So I had to resign from that, and I got a job as an instructor in Hong Kong without any trouble at all. It was very, very much easier. I mean, if I stayed in England, I could have got endless jobs as private pilot to people, because they were just beginning to own their own planes. Whereas before the war, the few that did have their private planes wouldn't contemplate a woman for love or money, you know. But after the war, yes, you know, you could get jobs.
How do you feel then, in retrospect, about your career in the ATA?
That I was a very, very lucky person to have had it, you know, to have been able to join the ATA and fly. I mean, I had, really, compared to other people, I had a marvellous war. Really enjoyed it. Well, very few people can say that. I had a marvellous time.